Thank you so much for coming. We're gonna try to respect everyone's time, and we're gonna jump right in on it. So this is, let me just give you the outline of how the evening is gonna go. We're gonna pray. Dr. Warren is gonna say a few things, and then it's gonna be open mic. We have a runner. Katie, you're our runner for our microphone. So if you wanna ask a question, she's gonna bring you the microphone. So everyone can hear your question. Everybody needs to hear your question. And then we're going to turn Dr. Warren loose on the question and answer. And then we're going to wrap up. And after we wrap up, we're going to eat pizza. And I think somebody got a veggie tray. I don't know why, but they got a veggie tray or something. I don't know. Anyway, so this is the way that's going to work. It's all going to be ready. We're going to set up tables in the fireside room. You go and you grab your drinks and your pizza and your piece of corn or whatever it is you're going to get. And then we're just going to invite everybody to come back into the worship center here, and we're going to make chairs. We'll turn chairs around, disconnect them. It's not rocket science. This is going to be real easy. And then you sit there and eat pizza on your lap and talk and have a good time. All right, so, hey, let's, a lot of you don't know who Darren is yet. Darren, come on up here. Darren is our new campus pastor down in Fountain. And he's going to pray, and then he's got an announcement about our trip to Houston in a couple weeks. So
a couple Fridays ago, Stu calls me and says, "Hey, Darren, do you have any interest in leading a team down to Houston and helping the people, you know, that were affected by the flood?" And how do you exactly respond to that question? No, I don't. Those people were flooded out, and there's a reason they were flooded out, and I don't want to go. Or do you say, "Sure," and he starts, "I'll do a week, you do a week." The next phone conversation is, "Let's combine the week, and would you lead it?" All right, now we still get more clear. So I am the person you want to talk to if you want to go, and there's still time to get on the plane, assuming that we have enough tickets. I think we almost have half the plane so far, so we're gonna rock that. We have like 16 people going, so you still have time to go.
Hey, buddy. We all heard from Jody this morning that you're not very good with details, and she's actually in charge.
She is in charge.
Yeah. So this is
so actually, clear. Jody, are you here? Yeah. Jody, raise your hand. That would actually be the person I would see before me. So. But tonight, one of us, and then we're going to have a meeting. If you want to know any more details about it, catch us in the fireside room during the pizza time, and we'll go off somewhere and have a meeting about the missions trip, all right? But let's open tonight in prayer and ask God to really open our minds again to the awesome reality, which I love this morning. I love doing that message this morning. The awesome reality that our faith is real, like the thing that we were learning in Fountain this morning, Stu, was that belief is necessary and faith is necessary, but that there's actually a foundation to our faith, something that really can walk away with it. So, Father in heaven, thank you so much for the opportunity to even be here, and thank you for this chance to investigate more about what you created, what you've done, and that it would deepen us in a way that would give us much more confidence when having interactions with people who still need to be introduced to your son, Jesus Christ. So we welcome this time, and we ask for instruction in Jesus' name. Amen.
Hey Darren, come on up here, Wade. Hey, let's be clear. If you're going to have a meeting, why don't you guys all meet right here? Is that okay? Because pizza will be crazy out there. So you guys all meet here, if that's good. Okay. Hey, guys, let's welcome Dr. Wade Warren, okay?
Okay, so if I'm going to do one of these talks in a public setting, I don't bring my Bible to the front, just so you know. So that's the smattering of laughter from Christian people. So you've had some introduction to me. I saw some of that introduction this morning that was shown here, but I wanted to say just a little bit about my background so that those of you who may be not as familiar with what's going on in these multiple church campuses that you guys have, we'll have some context. I am really just a glorified science teacher. I work at Louisiana College. I have some connections here. And I teach mostly anatomy and physiology and some upper-level neuroscience courses. I teach a significance in teaching course at the master's level for a certification program at the college. And I also teach some doctoral courses in gross anatomy online through the University of St. Augustine. So that's where I spend most of my time. But over the past few years, I've developed a couple of real passions. You know, as you get older, you start thinking to yourself, you know, Lord, I would like to be of more use to you. And so part of my progression in my adult life has been learning the Hebrew language. And I have managed over the last decade to learn enough to be dangerous. And I have found myself in the last decade also in a lot of public settings talking about my love for science, and in particular my love for young people, and giving them an opportunity to hear the whole story, as it were, about the state of the science that we have in our world today. So I asked at lunch today the crowd if they had looked my name up on the internet, hoping that they had not, because in giving expert testimony before multiple settings in Louisiana state government, and also giving testimony in the state Texas Board of Education science standards work, there have been some people who have written some things about me. And I was telling a young man before the service, they don't know me. And if they would just call and ask, I would explain it to them. And so I'm hoping that tonight will be some of that for you, that you will give me an opportunity to present evidence. I did one of these sessions at the University of Victoria a couple of years ago at their Veritas Forum. And the room was filled with faculty and students alike, and it was very warmly received, very professional setting, and a crowd about like this. And then afterwards, the question and answer time became very antagonistic, and some people got very angry during the conversation. And I want the spirit of the room here tonight, I hope, remains, as Stuart talked about this morning, one of very congenial. I'm going to respect your opinions and listen to what you have to say, and I hope that you will do the same with me. So I didn't want to put a downer on all this, but I like to say something up front about where I'm coming from. My research training is in neuroscience, in circadian biology, biological clocks, systems, neuronal tract tracing, if that means anything to anybody. I did a postdoctoral fellowship after my PhD at Georgia State University, after I did my PhD at Texas A&M, and that research was investigating the hormonal and neuroanatomical connections to adipose tissue formation. If you want some more information about the role the sympathetic nervous system plays in fat deposition, I'm your man. So then I left and became a faculty member at Louisiana College, where I've been for, this is now my 22nd year. And so I teach most of my time. I was telling some people beforehand, my research life has ended, but my interest in education has increased. And so I now feel like the Lord has provided opportunities for me, and this is one of them, where I get a chance to talk about science with believers, and the opportunity there is to educate. So congratulations to you guys. Church, really, in my opinion, should be education in the scriptures as a focus. So we're not really doing that tonight. We're talking about science. But as the young man said in his prayer, education and information can also very much encourage your faith. And so I have done a lot of work in this area, and I am very confident that the science in no way disproves the existence of a God. And I have the literature to back it up. So as a final piece here, before I go through a few slides to get you warmed up, over the past year, I've been working with the Louisiana Science Education Standards Committee. They asked me to be on the steering committee because they know I care. And the standards are very similar to the ones you have here in Colorado. They were modeled on a federal national standard set called the Next Generation Science Standards. If there are science teachers in the room, I see some nodding. And they are very good. They're based on what's called science and engineering best practices. And they're very practical. They have a lot of depth. They're not very shallow. And the standards are quite good, except in the area of evolutionary biology. So I did a lot of work for no pay to provide scores of scientific literature, peer-reviewed articles for the committee as they were doing their work and writing their standards. And if you're interested in seeing some of this confrontation, a couple of them were recorded. One of them where I asked some very pointed questions to the writers in New Orleans back last February. So if you go to the Louisiana Department of Education Twitter account, you can watch that video. It's a long video, but the part that I'm in is very interesting. And then I got beat bad, like outvoted 100-1. It was awful. And then I went to the meeting in Baton Rouge, that's our state capital, where the science standards were presented to the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education. I presented my case again, and I spent a lot of time in prayer about that beforehand. You know, Lord, I feel like I've wasted a lot of time here because these people do not want to know. I have provided the literature for them, and they have ignored it. And so I had 3 minutes to talk. So I very carefully worded my statement, finished, sat down. That's it. I guess I'm done here. At the end of that time, the not the superintendent, but the next guy in charge, named Gary Jones, asked if I would come back to the microphone along with a young lady who was on the standards committee who had presented a document to refute all of this. I was able actually to write a minority report that had to go in the record, which is why I wrote it. And so she had written a rebuttal to this, supposedly. They brought her down, and they sat the two of us in front of this huge room of people. And he began to ask her questions about the rebuttals that she had made in her document on the evidence that I had provided. And she had no idea what was in that document. And after the first question, I felt sorry for her, and so I chimed in to try to answer the questions for her. And as part of that, it became clear, she looked to the audience to see, can I get some help down here or whatever? And I said, I'll help you. And so we talked for a little bit, and the conversation turned to me completely. And I got, for the next 15 or 20 minutes, to lay out the case in front of the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education. I couldn't believe what was happening. As a result of that, there is a law in Louisiana called the Louisiana Science Education Act, which I also gave testimony concerning a few years prior. One of the board members said, we have to do something about this. We are not allowing our public school students an opportunity to be told the whole story. And what Dr. Warren has provided here provides the rest of the story. And we have to give our teachers access to this. How can we do that? So they added the language of the Science Education Act to the front of the standards. The superintendent tried to get in the way of that by saying, we are not going to let that happen. We don't need to do that. That's not required of us. And the lady called for a vote, and the superintendent got beat in that room. So, yeah, it was a hallmark moment in my life. So this would be the second moment in my life, Stuart, sitting in front of the people of this church talking about my love for science, my love for God. So thank you so much for the invitation to be here. I want to talk for just a couple of minutes. I'm already 17 minutes in. I want to talk for a couple of minutes about what I showed your young people this morning. I like to leave people with some nuggets, right? I want to stimulate the NMDA receptors of your hippocampus so that you can convert in your temporal lobe short-term into long-term memories, that these things will last somehow. You will hear nuggets, and when you hear someone arguing for evolutionary modeling, you'll say, wait a minute. So that's what I wanted. That was my goal this morning with your youth group, to give them some nuggets where they can say, as they're going through their science standards stuff in their schools, there's no way around it, people. It's happening in the public schools. And they are presenting a one-sided dogmatic view of the natural world that simply doesn't hold up with the weight of evidence we have today. So I put these three nuggets in their head. I'm going to show them to you, and then I have some other pretty pictures that I've used in other presentations and other places, and I'm hoping that that will stimulate the beginning of the questions. So let's go through this. Yes? We're on? Okay, so let's get a little interaction to start this. The youth group did a good job, no pressure. This guy, Michael Shermer, wrote this book. He's not a Christian, member of a skeptic society. I like him because he questions everything. They did a big survey and asked a couple of questions of several thousand people, all right? The first question was, why do you think other people believe in God? Okay, so if I asked you this question, why do you think that other people, not you, other people believe in God? Give me some feedback.
Family.
So we got that this morning. So your mom and dad were believers or whatever else. So that's why I believe, because my parents believe.
Experience,
okay? So they're looking around their world. They're seeing things, and they believe because they've had experiences that they think God is real. Anything else?
To be on the safe side.
Okay, to be on the safe side, yeah? Just in case there is a heaven. All right. Yes, you had one? Okay. So some fire insurance. Yeah.
Hope.
Okay, yeah. So they believe in God because they want to believe, they want to hope for the future. Yes, sir. Okay, so they've had somebody talk to them about the science. Okay, great. So here's what he found. Next slide. This is what people in our country said. Other people believe because God is a crutch. Isn't that interesting? God is a support. He helps them through the day. He provides a moral structure, helps me make sense out of life. So that goes along with some of the stuff you said. Here's the second question he said. Why do you believe? Now, I don't put anybody on the spot. So this was not a question proposed to people in the church. So a person obviously had to not be an atheist. They believed that there is a God, and the question was why. So obviously there were a lot of questions. You want to guess what the number one response was?
Strong anthropic principle.
Say again?
The strong anthropic principle.
Oh, the anthropic principle. Oh, man, we're going to get some questions here tonight. Am I going to have to talk about that? Well, what are you doing here? This is biology. I'm kidding, of course, yes. The anthropic principle, yes. Yes, what do you think?
Because it takes too much faith not to believe in God.
Okay. Here's what I told your kids this morning. I said, when I walk out of the back door of my house, I look, there's pine trees and grass. I drive down the road, cornfields, soybeans, cotton, more pine trees. When I walk out the door of this church, there's a different view. Yeah? I say, you know, to me, how can you live in the mountains and be an atheist? Yeah, so here's the number one answer. The design, order, and complexity of the universe. Yeah, so even people who are not in church have a sense. It's something that frustrates the Darwinian crowd immensely, that so many people have a sense that there is design in the universe. And certainly physics is a more powerful tool to talk about design. He's right about that. So, but I'm not a physicist. So anyway, design in the universe, this has an impact. Doug Axe has just come out with a new book recently called Undeniable. I highly recommend it. And he goes through sort of documenting this principle that human beings are born with this idea that we live in a world that was made, that it was designed. And it's very difficult to get that out of their psyche. It's almost like you have to pummel that with Darwinism in the public school system in order to reorient, you know, redo their brain so that they now believe there is no God. Okay, so we'll go through the next ones quickly. I'll show you. I have some quotations from Darwin if you're interested. His famous work on the Origin of Species has a lot of very interesting quotations in it. I've got a couple in this presentation. We can talk about that. If you want to talk about Darwin and his quotations, we can do that. This was the one that I used with your kids this morning to talk about the fossil record. So go to the next one. This is the first item I wanted to imprint in their mind. So what does the fossil record actually say? Well, the first thing that we know about the fossil record is the expectation that Darwin had was that the fossil record would be filled in over time, because he knew when he wrote his work that this idea that organisms evolve from simple to more complex forms, this idea that there would be an innumerable, unimaginably large number of transitional forms that we would find in the fossil record simply did not exist. Here's the problem. Since that time, that problem in the fossil record has gotten worse and not better. And we know now, this is the number one item. We can talk about transitionals if you want to, but the number one item in the fossil record is the observation of the Cambrian explosion. So this morning, a couple of kids had seen this in their book, and I showed them a quotation out of their textbook. I looked it up before I came, and I showed them the quotation, which says the Cambrian explosion is a time period during Earth's history when nearly all of the animal phyla, that is, the animal body plans that are strategies for the living things in this world, show up at one time in the fossil record. And I asked the kids, what does that sound like to you? All of the animal body plans showing up at one time in the fossil record. So this is a major problem with the Darwinian model. Here's the second one that I showed them this morning, and you guys are familiar with this. Keep going. We'll go through these quickly. You saw this morning on the video. This is actually, I should have said this up front. I steal things from other people. So what I am telling you is not information that I discovered or invented. I read a lot. So the things that I'm telling you, many other people have said. I'm not alone here. And so this idea was first presented by Michael Behe back in the mid-90s in his monumental work. I know some of you are familiar with it, Darwin's Black Box. Now, we now know of many, many other irreducibly complex systems. And if you want to talk about it some more tonight, let's do it. This is what Darwin used, the morphology, the anatomy of the eye, to talk about. He knew that organs of extreme perfection were a problem for his ideas. And so he explained them using structure, using anatomy. He said, look, a very simple eye, very simple life form. Look, a little more complex life form, a little more complex eye. This one's compound. Look, a more complex eye. This one has a lens in it. And so he said, We can imagine transitional intermediates by looking at the changes in the eyes through the organism. I mean, even in the mollusks, you can do this. You don't even have to get outside of one phylum to do it. The problem is Darwin didn't know the biochemistry. This has just become information available to us during my lifetime in science. And so Behe points this one out. The next one, this is the biochemistry of vision. These are systems that are irreducibly complex. That is, a whole sequence of things have to happen in order for you to see. Now, in a Darwinian model, to get from simple to complex, you have to be able to plug in intermediates. You have to be able to tell a story where you plug in the individual parts of this. So we should be able to experimentally walk backwards by removing pieces of it and seeing what happens to the visual systems. And you heard this morning, right? What's the problem with removing a piece of this? Blindness. That is not a good adaptation. This organism is not going to survive, which is, of course, the hallmark. Reproduction and survivability. That's the two hallmarks of the Darwinian model. Okay, so let's go to the next one. I told them about that. This one you recognize from the morning also. We talked about this at lunch today. Great conversation. Gentleman asking me a question. Give me the number one, right? What really speaks to this? And we're talking about how you define life. I don't know how you define life. So we're talking about the RNA world hypothesis and all kinds of cool stuff at lunch. And I said, well, I'm going to grant the science community that they got life somehow. Let's walk it backwards now. We've got the strand of nucleotides. Does it matter the order of the bases in the nucleotide strand? Yeah, if you make a mistake, you got a major problem. So much of function in life is dictated by the DNA molecule. So you have to have, in a model of life and science, a way to explain how you got this molecule in its current structure. And as the video said, Crick admits this openly. This is a major problem. I mean, they throw this out to aliens now, the order of these base pairs. This is a major problem. So that was the third piece, and you guys have heard those. So here are a few others. Let's go through some of these together so you can just see it. Let's do the exercise that I did with them. We'll finish with that. Next slide. Okay, so here's the code, right? The DNA is a coded language. If y'all want to talk some more about it, let's do that. But this is Stephen Meyer and others have, written scores about this. But this is coded language specifically targeted at your kids this morning. So in the genes that are in the DNA sequence, in these genes, you have three letters that code for single amino acids. We call them codons. So I made my own code. On the left-hand side of the screen, there are codes for letters. Up at the top are the letters RCFRKOS. That is pronounced Rockafrickus. So you laughed and then you stopped because you thought, well, maybe he does mean something. That's gibberish, right? That's gibberish. That's not language. DNA is language to the cell, coded language. So you can't answer. My drummer sitting here on the second row, he saw this morning. Tell me, what is the code? What does it say? Four rocks. Now, Randy Unruh, this was his idea. Does anybody have any other significance about what that means? What is F-O-R? Fellowship of the Rockies. Rocks. Yeah, that's my effort to be cool in front of the young people. You rock. I'm not sure what that means. But Randy knows, and so they got it. All right, so let's go to the next one. Those were the three. I told them thanks for the invite. F-O-R rocks. All right, so here's some other things to stimulate your minds. We can talk about what it means to say evolution. This is a very important definition. If you want to talk about that, keep coming. We can talk about the fossil record. We can talk about homology. Stuart wanted to talk about homology. yesterday at breakfast, I think it was. I don't remember now. I've had so many times with people. Embryology, arguably the most famous Darwinian thing, are Darwin's finches. I'm looking around the room to see nodding. People have heard about the Galapagos Islands and that story, the story of the finches. Peter and Rosemary Grant's Pulitzer Prize-winning book on the finches. Okay, we can talk about that. So here's some pretty homology pictures. This is the one you were referring to, Stuart, with the common limbs. Keep coming. This is the embryology story. We can talk about homology with the embryological data, and we can look at this together. Keep coming. This is more evidence of problems with homology and genetics. Am I getting anybody interested? Keep coming. This is more genetic stuff or the development of eyes, homologies. This is just literature that supports the idea that homology is no longer a valid argument for evolution. Keep coming. Convergence. Convergent evolution, really? I mean, come on. So look at the next picture. On the left-hand side, you see a group of marsupials. And on the right-hand side, a group of mammals. They look very similar. The Darwinian crowd looks at this. They live on different continents. They have a very different reproductive strategy, very different way of raising their young. They're not considered having evolved from the similar common ancestor, but yet they look the same. The Darwinist says convergent evolution. The same evolutionary path happened over there that happened over there. When the odds of the first one happening are roughly the odds of one in the total number of molecules in the known universe, and now you're going to tell me this happened twice? So very difficult things for Darwinian crowd. Keep coming. This is more on the embryology from the textbook. I didn't get to go through this with the kids this morning. Keep coming. These are the pictures that Haeckel faked. Some of you have heard about Haeckel's fake embryology drawings. We can talk about that. Keep coming. This is the predictions from Darwin's finches here. And so we'll talk about that if you want. Keep coming. So I did all that just to warm you up. We can talk about any of that you want. We can ask questions now. I am 30 minutes in. So, but in my defense, the preachers took the first 10.
That was not true. Okay. All right, so Katie, this is how we're going to do it. Katie's got the microphone. You raise your hand, and Katie will bring you the microphone. So I will ask the first question unless a hand goes up real quick. Okay, there you go. We'll get Steve, and then we'll go on from there. Okay.
I'm worried just to start this.
The strong anthropic principles refers to the fact that not only the complexity of the standard model and the different forces, but the relationships between these forces and particles, such as between hadrons and leptons, that allow the universe to exist the way it is now, that if it was different, anything was different along the line, the universe as we know it wouldn't exist. We wouldn't have stars, we wouldn't have planets, we wouldn't have these different materials, we wouldn't even have the possibility of evolution. In the beginning of the last century, the model for how the physical world operated was very simple, but it's become not simple, but rather much, much more complex because of increased methods of measuring the different particles and forces in the universe. Some scientists have tried to deal with this by coming up with a theory called the multiverse. In other words, okay, our universe is so unique and so special that it allows life as we know it, and it allows the structure of the universe to exist as we know it. But it's this way because there's thousands of universes which we can't observe anywhere, before, after us, this way, that way, or whatever, that allow for the randomness effect to take place in our universe. So my question is this, is do you ever think about the anthropic principle just in terms of the universe? And don't you think if you have to make up things that can't be verified, like a multiverse, that in a sense you're saying, well, I don't believe in God, but there's some other thing going on which I can't even prove that allows this model to exist?
Okay, before you answer that, So, Katie, grab the microphone. And the next question, raise your hand, and Katie will take it to you. Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
That's how we'll do it every time.
This gentleman is better informed about the anthropic principle than I am. But I have read a little bit about the fine-tuning of the universe. And so my understanding is that you are correct, that things have to be placed in just such fashion. And there are a number of these items about where the planets are, et cetera, that require very fine tuning. Otherwise, there would be no possibility of life. I don't have a physics background. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to help you more with that. But I would add to that, there is a gentleman by the name of Jay Richards, who's written a couple of books and produced a video titled The Privileged Planet, in which he makes a very strong case about the position of the planet Earth for discovery. And I really love the arguments that he made in that video. But thank you for your comments. I'm not going to be of any more use to you. Okay. Well, great. Thank you so much for being here and offering that.
Dr. Warren, thank you for coming to our church to speak. We appreciate having you here.
Yeah, he's a plant.
I wondered if you'd mentioned Haeckel's embryos. Wondered if you might expound a little bit on some of the, I guess, hoaxes that have been fostered in science on society over the years. There's Haeckel's embryos, there's Piltdown Man. There's a few of those. Could you comment?
Yeah, so
you want to go back to the slide?
It's okay. We can I think we can do it quickly.
Okay.
So the embryo story is a fascinating one about I said to word it kindly in science terms. These images that Haeckel drew about embryological forms were manufactured to highlight the idea that he had. And his idea, his original idea, was this very famous idea called phylogeny recapitulates ontogeny, kind of thing, form. And so I see some nodding in the room. But he was discovered many years ago. And the drawings that he showed in the textbooks that the students are using for these embryos were drawn in a way to highlight their similarities. So the argument is really a homology argument, which says if it's similar, this is what homology says, they must be related in evolutionary terms. One descended from the other if they're similar. And so he was discovered. And you would think, after that discovery of the fake drawings, that they would disappear altogether from science textbooks. But they have not. And so this is one of the things that I tried to point out to the Louisiana science writers, that these kind of things need to be corrected. Now, I've seen people interviewed about these things. Eugenie Scott was interviewed about this. You saw, I have her on video. And her response to this question, why do these obviously well-known fake drawings still exist as arguments for evolutionary biology in our kids' textbooks? And she said, well, it's been known for some time that Haeckel faked his drawings, but the basic principle that he was putting forth is actually still valid. And so when I show that video to students, a lot of times they'll say, now wait a minute, it's okay to lie as long as the underlying point is something that you want to make. Now, the other point you brought up Piltdown and Nebraska Man. So the area of human evolution is a very controversial area. And, of course, you know many people have written about problems in this area. But I've gleaned from this something that I think can help people as they read material about human evolution. So if you start reading about all the different versions of the Australopithecines, et cetera, and the dating of those things, whenever these fossil finds, like Lucy, for example, whenever these fossil finds come known to the public, the individuals and their lab become world famous individuals. The bones that are discovered become almost religious relics. And so it should not surprise us that a tooth of a pig would be given credit for having been some kind of ancestral form in human evolution, because you guys know human nature. And if you want to be famous in science, if you find something, if you make a discovery about a fossil, a human, pre-human fossil, and it can be argued that it is some kind of pre-human form, then you will become an instant celebrity in science. And so the motivation for that and the motivation to interpret fossils like that becomes enormous. I took some time. Casey Luskin wrote this book about all the various forms, skull forms that have been found from all the different pre-human evolutionary forms. And so I went through his book, reading it, and of course I can't regurgitate all of that to you. I don't remember all of it, but the sense of it is this. It requires a great deal of interpretation. So what is the angle of the hole in the occipital bone, the foramen magnum? Human would be more vertical, more superior inferior. As you move that hole in the angle for an organism that would be more bent forward, more likely to be on all four limbs, you would expect the angle of the foramen magnum to change. And so that becomes a matter of interpretation. How do you measure that angle? And who's checking the people measuring the angle? So I am extremely suspicious of the stories because of Piltdown and Nebraska Man and Heckel's embryos. I am extremely skeptical about presentations for things where supposed human ancestry has been discovered. And I think we all should be. I am not ruling it out as a scientist, but I need for these people to make better arguments than they're making about the fossils they're finding. And many times, the thing that made Lucy so famous in Johansson's lab was he found a complete skeleton. Well, come to find out, the head of that skeleton was actually found several meters, like 30 meters away from where the scapula was. And so they make the assumption that these bones go together. I'm not buying. So it can be argued, okay? And like we talked about at lunch today a little bit, some of the icons that we have in the area of intelligent design have different ideas. So if you ask Michael Behe about pre-human evolution, he's going to tell you, because of his work in pseudogenes, that it's possible from his molecular stuff that there were pre-human forms. So people have different opinions, and I think we should listen to those. And we should make all of that information available to everyone. But, as you've pointed out, we should be skeptical. Especially, so this is where the religion part comes in, and I would never say this in a science setting, but especially when it contradicts what the biblical authors have presented to us. So ultimately in my life, Scripture is going to have authority. And if that makes me biased, so be it.
Okay. Another.
So I may need your help in helping me to frame this question just a little bit. But
okay.
I've always loved science, and I've always loved faith, and I've studied them both independently. But putting them together, I think it's very interesting in this part
what,
of this.
What book have you talking about? You said I've studied the book.
She loves science. And she loves
Sorry. Let me hold this a little bit closer.
You love
here.
Science? Yes.
I love science, and I love faith, please, and I study them.
Please speak slowly. I'm from Louisiana. Just one word at a time. Okay.
So as a part of this Equipped series, it sounds a little bit like we're trying to create a conversation, an argument to have with one of our friends. And I know that in studying intelligent design, the conversation that I've had before is this whole concept of the God of the gap. sure, there's all this stuff that we can't explain, and so we fill the gap with God, and what happens when the gap gets smaller? What happens when the evidence provides other understanding? Where does our argument go? And I think one of the things that's really interesting for me is that what you've presented so far is that there's this Darwin of the gap, that there was all this stuff that there wasn't evidence for, and now that evidence seems to push us towards God, towards intelligent design. But what happens to our faith if we hang it on that and then something moves?
That is a great question. Yeah, I try, and I'm glad that you've noticed this. I try every time I give talks to young people or otherwise to be very careful in presenting the science as not, so this is going to sound a little, okay, so I'm just going to say it. If your argument is just look around you, you should realize there's a God. Or if your argument is it's just too complex, so I'm just going to say God did it. In the science world, you are not making a valid argument. So in the science world, we take evidence and we try to put on that evidence the best explanation we can for the evidence we're observing. So I am a strong opponent of the idea of the God of the gaps. It is not going to ultimately help faith, because as you pointed out, these gaps over time are going to be filled in. Now, when I mentioned the fossil record, what I meant by that was we have a nearly complete fossil record now. And so there are fossil finds continuing to come online. There's a new one in China, one up in British Columbia in the Burgess Shale. And the fossils that they're finding are things that we already have. Or they are adding to the story that has already been told. They're not filling in Darwin's gaps in the fossil record. One individual worded it like this: there should be so many forms, so many transitional forms, there should be dats and cogs and everything in between. And Darwin, frankly, expected that. So Archaeopteryx was the supposed reptile bird that was described, you know, late in his life, and he thought, oh, thank God, they're starting to find them now. He didn't say thank God, right? Oh, thank goodness. They're starting to find them now. But your point is a very good one. So when I make the case, I want to say, let's look at the evidence that we have before us and use parsimony. Yes? The most logical explanation for what we see. What is the best explanation for the evidence we have? So take the Cameron explosion, for example. So is the model that says there is innumerable transitional forms and we would have to work our way back in animal body plans to something very simple, the best thing to explain that observation that we have about the Cambrian fossil finds? So if you ask the group that's published the latest work out of China on their find there, they don't have an agenda over there. They're just presenting their evidence, their data. And when T.C. Chin was interviewed, he said, I think the Darwinian model should probably be the other way around. So the Darwin tree of life starts with a single living thing, and it branches out into all these living things, right? But what they're finding is all these living things are already in the fossil record, in the original fossil finds of living things. And so if anything, he says, the number of species has gone this way. The number is reduced over time in terms of animal body plans, phylum, phyla. So it's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up, and I hope I don't do that tonight. When I make the case from the DNA molecule, I say it's a coded language, and I try to get behind other scientists, you know, Francis Collins, an evolutionary evangelical guy. He gave a talk at Tulane a couple years ago. One of my students in med school down there called me up. Oh, Dr. Warren, Francis Collins is here. Should I tell him I know you? No, he doesn't know Wade Warren. He doesn't know who I am. I know what you talk about him all the time. Well, I don't agree with what he says in the rest of his book, but at least he's honest in the opening chapter of his book to say, look, this is a language of life. You cannot explain this with science. So what is the best explanation? Francis Crick says, aliens.
Hey, so I just want to make sure, did we catch the question right and did it get answered for you? Okay, go. I just don't mind make sure we heard it right.
Okay,
we got another one.
Young Earth, old Earth, something else, and does it matter for Christians? And how old were the dinosaurs, really?
Could we have security come and escort him, Murray?
Yeah, he's been a problem for me for multiple years.
Do you
now.
Have security? Because
yeah.
Some little smart aleck Colorado native asked me this question at lunch too. Yeah. I gave a talk at first, a series of talks. They invited me for 3 consecutive weeks. They know I teach biology. They know I love God. My kids are Christians, so they think I must know something about Jesus. So come to our church and give us some talks on evolution, etc. Older gentleman in the church, I presented to them the Cambrian explosion, right? 300 million years ago. And he says, yeah, how do you know how old the earth is, etc. The question at lunch was, talk to me about dating techniques. We talk about potassium argon and the decay of strontium and carbon-14 dating. And I'm thinking, oh, Lord, I can't do this. I don't know the answers to these questions. So I have friends. So let's say it this way. I have friends who are young earth creationists. There's a guy who works in our department, Dan Criswell. He's written a lot of papers, worked for the Institute for Creation Research, and good friends with Henry Morris. Good friends with Ken Ham at Answers in Genesis. Great Christian guy. He's a young earth guy. And he tells the story of young earth stuff in his classes at Louisiana College. I have very good friends. Some of my closest friends work for Discovery. Doug Axis, one of these guys. Casey Luskin and John West and many others. And these guys are like, there's too much evidence for old earth, Wade, this kind of thing. And so the legal system has taken on this question on a couple of occasions. It was actually a Louisiana law that was struck down by the Supreme Court for teaching creationism, young earth creationism. Did y'all know it is illegal in this country to teach creationism in a biology class? Okay? Young earth creationism. Because the big push there was, you know, with all the stupid people in Louisiana, we need to teach creationism to the biology classroom, right? And so that got struck down. That's religion, right? So I'm always very careful not to say creationism. And I told the people, one group we were with this weekend, if I can be tagged as a creationist, I have lost my opportunity to talk to someone. They don't want to hear about vision. They don't want to hear about homology. They don't want to hear about fossils. They don't want to hear anything. I am suddenly unable to think if I call myself a creationist, especially a young earth creationist. So I have friends who are old earth guys, right? The Hugh Ross group, Reasons to Believe. The group out in Seattle, Discovery. These are old earth guys. They both call themselves creationists, and they attack one another regularly. The rest of the scientific community looks at that, and they go, that's fine. Let them argue. When we have so much science to talk about with young people in our schools, that does not agree with the current scientific dogma, the evolutionary model. We get caught up in arguing with each other about how old the earth is. So I'm going to be obtuse and say, and if you would like for me to demonstrate this with the Hebrew, I can. Stuart knows that, and our lunch friends from lunch today know this. We spent almost 2 hours with it, if that's any consolation for you. I don't think the Hebrew writing of Genesis requires an individual to be either.
And I'm going to stop it right there.
Okay.
Because guys, this is a huge discussion, and he would love to talk to you about it. He's publishing a book on it. We have freedom to share the manuscript right now. I mean, yeah. When you gave it to me, I was. When I get freedom to share the manuscript, I have it in PDF form. We can share it with you. It just goes down the road, and again, there's no need to make this the only focus in the Church of Jesus Christ. So
yeah, and you probably have seen this before. I have had, because I won't allow someone to put me in a box with this. The gentleman at the church at First Baptist Pineville stood up and walked out.
So, I think what he answered your question, Matt. You said,
I did not answer his question.
No, he said, old earth, young life, or does it matter? And Dr. Warren just came in the camp. It doesn't matter. That's the most important thing to take away from that. So, is that fair? Not matter. But that's a tough word, isn't it?
Yeah, it does matter.
Like that.
It does matter in the sense.
I messed up.
It matters in the sense that you need to continue to listen to the evidence coming out of the scientific community. There are arguments for both, and I think those arguments should be made available to everyone.
What you clearly believe, and you said this, is as and he's very good in the Hebrew language. He talks like he's not. He's very good in the Hebrew language. As he reads it in the original Hebrew language, you just don't believe Genesis 1 has to dictate either.
Right.
Is that correct?
Is that okay?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Afterwards, we can talk.
All right.
Some
no,
more.
No. We got okay. Pete, is that you next? Okay.
Yes. Thank you very much. I'm very interested in all of these topics. It's really, really great stuff. Over the last 20 years, there's been several discoveries by paleontologists of soft tissue found in dinosaur bones.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you're familiar with all those and what do you make of it?
Well, I don't know about the dinosaur things, but one of the arguments, so just stop me if I'm going off in a direction you don't want to go to, but soft tissue dinosaur things, you're talking about embryos found? Oh, okay. So what's the question then? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I thought you were going to talk about the Cambrian embryos, but okay. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. Yep. I would appreciate the word reactionary. Yeah, most of the time it's a bumpkin from Louisiana, a Bible thumper, you know, that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Okay,
it's
we
a good
got,
question.
I promised my high schooler I'd ask this question, and it is going back to the age of the earth and carbon dating. And so this book that Pastor Stewart mentioned, that's what you're focusing on in your book?
No.
Okay.
The chapter that Stuart's talking about walks through the Hebrew of the first chapter of Genesis. So you're not going to be able to present that to your students.
No, it's for my daughter. But I'm studying Hebrew as well, so that's very intriguing to me.
Where are you taking Hebrew?
Online.
Really?
Yeah, the biblical Hebrew. So, yay,
yeah,
I'm really excited.
Outstanding.
That.
Okay. Okay, find somebody else here. There we go. We don't like people who do online biblical languages. That's crazy. Why would anybody do that?
Yes, sir.
I've done a lot of research into like various theories with creationism.
Okay, I'm
we can't hear.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. There was a YouTube video out not too long ago talking about science proving God. And there was even a quote from Stephen Hawking saying that our human biology is way too complex to just come into existence. But he also says that he's trying to find evidence that God doesn't exist, even though he just practically said it does.
Yeah.
How is that even possible?
For Stephen Hawking to say both, I mean, you'd have to ask him. But I do find it interesting how, as scientists get older, they tend to get more honest. And they get to places in their life where they have been having these discussions in bars over a beer with their buddies for a long time, but they weren't courageous enough to publish this work. And now they've got nothing to lose. And so they're going to be honest with us about what they really think. And I think, if you ask me, that's what's happening to Hawking. Yeah. I was going to imitate him. That would have been rude.
Dr. Warren, given your background in anatomy and biology,
yes,
your thoughts on technologies like cloning and the current state of stem cell research?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've gotten that one before about cloning. So that's a political question, really. But for those of us who are in the church, we can't ignore it. So I believe that life is sacred. If I'm reading, so this is a Bible answer, this is a political question, this is my knowledge of anatomy. Is not going to inform me about whether or not I agree with cloning. Am I interpreting your question correctly? Give her the mic back. Okay.
Okay. From a DNA perspective.
Oh, how does cloning work?
No, not. But oh. In terms of everything you
talked about. I could do
that
one, Stu.
The DNA molecule, the DNA strand being so specific, where are we taking off with cloning, okay, if it becomes more and more prevalent?
So you're talking about human engineering stuff?
Human engineering stuff, yes.
So the Human Genome Project opened this box, really, because now we know the sequence of the roughly 38,000 to 40,000 genes in the human genome. So the first question really that most people approach this with is, how can we solve genetic health problems? So for example, sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis, where we know what the mutations are that cause this, how do you now fix the DNA in order to fix this human health problem? So that's the first level. To this date, we don't have an easy solution to that, because the only things we have at our disposal now to change the DNA of a living thing are viruses, retroviruses specifically, that can invade the cell and rewrite the code. But that creates a whole new set of problems, and the testing that's been done with that has led to some catastrophic problems with cancers. Now, the question about human engineering, I think, is we're told by the powers that be, because they want our money, that we're very close to being able to engineer humans. And so, you know, I want to be able to change the code so that my kids have blonde hair instead of dark hair. That kind of science is still years away, unless we're willing to accept some really horrific procedures where we eliminate embryos that do not have the specific codes we're looking for. So at this point, it's more a Darwinian fashion where you have to in vitro produce lots and lots of embryos, and then you have to do genetic testing on each one of them. And then you're going to have to destroy the ones that you don't want to, in a Darwinian fashion, select the ones that you do. I am vehemently opposed to that kind of human manipulation. And I think our knowledge of DNA allowing us to go down that road is going to be as catastrophic, if not more so, than what has happened since Roe v. Wade in the 70s, with 50 million unborn humans murdered. Did that help? Okay. Yes, sir, we have a young person in the back with a question.
I'm
sorry, you have the mic. Okay. I'm sorry.
So, what did you just tell him, Stu?
I said, he ain't young.
Oh. I've long been of the opinion that if Darwin were alive today, he would not be an evolutionist, based on the quote that you put on the screen. So earlier today, I was scanning through his On the Origin of the Species, looking for that quote, which I didn't find. But I found some very fascinating other references to Darwin's belief in a creator and creation. So I'm wondering whether that aspect of Darwin's theory is it ever comes up in debates that you've been involved in.
Yeah, it's a great observation. Of course, he started his training as a minister.
You want to show that one?
Yeah, you can back so you can see the reference where it comes from. It's out of chapter 6. So.
Just one, but that doesn't talk about a creator specifically.
Oh, right, right.
A creator specifically.
Yes, he does. That is in either chapter 1 or 2.
14.
It's in 14?
Oh.
Okay. Yeah, it's never come up. Yeah. Yeah, and he has some very interesting letters. If you want to do searching, look for the conversation, the letters that he wrote back and forth with Charles Lyell. And those conversations also have some of that language where he is concerned about. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's not much there. And so I guess the evolutionary crowd is going to hide behind that. But I think it's a little bit primitive on my part to only quote Darwin, because, of course, in Darwin's day, there was no knowledge of genetics. And so a neo-Darwinist is not the same thing as a Thomas Huxley, old school evolutionary biologist.
So
the neo-Darwinist has what they consider to be a toolkit to explain natural selection. That is, mutations afford the animal advantages in reproduction and survivability. And then they add to that toolkit today all this gene duplication stuff. So we've got, you know, a lot of genes that code for different things in our nose, smell, the smell sense. And so a lot of that is duplication. And so the argument today in the neo-Darwin crowd is very different than the way Darwin made his argument. They're going to say, you know, we've got a toolkit to work with now. We don't have to talk about fossils anymore. So a lot of times in my conversations, it turns to molecular biology. And you can see my bias here and my presentation to that, because I'm sensitized to that. They don't want to talk about the Cameron explosion, and they don't want to talk about intermediates in the fossil record.
So let me just follow up to that. Is there any, in the secular world, the majority of the secular scientific community, there's no conversation about this anymore, it's just a given? Is that?
Conversation about what?
About the thoughts behind Darwin, and is there a creator, or it's totally gone away.
That is taboo in science. If you mention God or religion, you have crossed the line. Obviously. However, in his defense, it was a different era, and he knew in those days all of the bright minds went into ministry. I'm thinking in today's world, I couldn't resist that one. So the reason he pursued ministry, being pushed by his family, was so that he could pursue science. Because he knew, all of the great scientists were trained religion professionals in those days. So, yeah, in his defense, it's no surprise. He could have been covering his back with that.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a NICU nurse, and we currently save babies at 23 weeks, and that number obviously keeps changing. I know this is a loaded question, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, and I know it's an opinion, but I'm curious to know, we struggle all the time with the medical knowledge we have, that a lot of times what we are doing is not necessarily what we perceive as an optimal outcome. So I'm just curious, looking to someone who does know a lot about science and obviously faith, what your opinion is on that. I don't know.
Can you be specific? If I make up a scenario, would you nod?
If what?
If I make up a scenario, would you nod if that's what you're asking?
Yeah, I guess I'm just curious to know, I mean, where do we draw the line? I know it's not a definitive answer, but are we doing too much? Maybe is...
Doing too much to save lives?
Yeah, I mean, as a believer, there's times where, you know, we're like, why are we doing this? Yes, we have some of this medical knowledge, but then there's that argument, well, every life is worth saving. And it's hard to be somewhere, I mean, I think most of us are somewhere in the middle, but I'm just curious to know maybe where you fall.
Yeah, I'm not going to be in the middle on that. There are, in my opinion, so last year we did a conference on our campus, and we brought in from St. Francis Cabrini Hospital, it's in the Christus Hospital Group, their end-of-life specialist, the person that helps families make these decisions about end-of-life and when to save a life and when not, she's involved with that all the time. And in her discussion of this, there were several scenarios that she brought up that simply do not have easy answers. So I'm not going to pretend like I have answer to all of those questions, because if you're in the medical community, you know better probably than most people in this room that it's not so simple a lot of times making these decisions about what's going on at the end. So, yeah. Yeah. So again, I'm not going to be neutral on that issue. I would be extraordinary measures to try to save the child. But again, I'm not in your shoes. One of the scenarios she brought up that really got to my heart was they had a woman in the hospital who was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she's pregnant. And she's stage 4. They've got to treat her very aggressively or she doesn't survive. But if they treat her very aggressively, the child dies. So mama dies or baby dies. Now, what are you going to do with this? So there are questions in the medical community, I'm admitting this to you because you asked for my opinion, that are very difficult. And so I pray for you guys. I don't face those decisions, but God bless you for being a believer in that. That is the answer that I would give, yes.
Dr. Warren, at lunch, you mentioned two words that you were involved in. You testified at an educational situation in Louisiana. One of the things I respect about what you've been doing recently is that you're concerned about our educational systems and what our kids are not being exposed to. And you said that you tried to introduce two words into legislation. Right. I would love for the audience to hear that story.
Okay. At the meeting that I mentioned to you in New Orleans, where I confronted the writers of the standards, I had actually written I'd become more aggressive. So I wrote an article to the newspaper trying to pressure them. You know, if they want to call names, okay, let's go to the public. That's fine. I've got nothing to lose. I'm not going to be fired over this. So the challenge was wide open. So in some sense, they came to that meeting already. There's nothing that that gray-haired, flat-top, goofy-looking guy over there is going to say that's going to change my mind. We are going after him. And they had done their homework. They were all on the same page. So the document that I had written for them was a very easy to understand. A fifth grader could read it. Where the science standard that was proposed was given, and then a rewording of that standard to better reflect the literature, and then citations of peer-reviewed science literature to follow to back up the change in the wording. So they completely ignored it. So I got the mic, and I got to ask these writers point blank why they refused. The director, who happened to be a Christian lady from Monroe, Kathy Cox, she says, because I talked to her about it, she says, Wade, why don't you walk us through this? So, you know, it was a seven-page document. I thought, well, okay, if you want to be here all afternoon. So the first one was wording about the fossil record, and it said that students should be taught, I'm paraphrasing, I showed it verbatim to your kids this morning, students should be taught about the fossil record, the existence and diversity and extinction and change of life form, a whole list of adjectives about the fossil record in order to support the Darwinian model. So I happen to know that one of the most famous evolutionary biologists in history in the modern era is a man by the name of Stephen Jay Gould. Now, he died several years ago, but he taught evolution at Harvard for years. And he proposed a new idea, a new neo-Darwinian idea that's still in the textbooks today called punctuated equilibria. Just looking around the room for people who've heard the term. And he developed that idea based on two observations about the fossil record. And he says this openly. Number one is sudden appearance. And number two is stasis. Stasis means things are not changing. So I suggested to the group that we add those two words to that standard. No one in science would disagree that the fossil record shows sudden appearance and stasis. This has been published. It's in the textbook. I brought a copy of the Miller text, and I said, it's right here. I showed it to your kids this morning, quoted about the Cameron explosion. Why can't the kids know this? The two words I wanted to add to the standard were sudden appearance. Now, the faculty member from LSU who was there, and I won't mention her name because this is being recorded, and it could end up on the internet. She says to me, we have a problem with that language. My response was, what is the problem? I've provided the citations. I provided the evidence from the scientific literature. I use citations from the most famous evolutionary biologist that I could think of. And she says, well, I'll have to explain that to you after the meeting. As though to say, you poor, dumb little man from Louisiana College. And my response was, no, no. I want you to explain it to me in front of all these people. The camera's on. Tell me why we can't add sudden appearance to that language. And she didn't utter a word. No one in the room uttered a word. And when I brought this up before the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education, it infuriated the board. So my post perspective was, their refusal to address the evidence added language to the Louisiana science standards. And in the final analysis, if a teacher in Louisiana wants to present the Cameron explosion to their students as evidence of sudden appearance in the fossil record, they are free to do so because of the way those standards are now listed. Now, it's going to take some courage. It's going to take some courage for these science teachers to do this. But I'm already getting contacts from from principals in the state. And this course that Stuart has these links to that I'm teaching to the master's kids, I walk them through the process, and I show them all the literature in that. Plus, I have a lot of videos to support this from other scientists talking about these things, and that is causing a stir in the public schools, to which I say, Lord, would you work in the hearts of these people? Would you allow them to see the dogma that is being imposed on our public school kids? The teachers are terrified. They don't want to say anything that would make them lose their job or somehow be perceived as not being in the mainstream of science. But so that was step number one in the standard thing. And I'd be thrilled if there's somebody in this room who's involved in your school board or somewhere else, let me send you this document. I did a lot of work on this document, and it's all listed with citations from the scientific literature, and you are welcome to it. I will share it with you gladly.
Hey, Randy, what do you got time for us? So, give me, do we got 5 minutes? Okay. Oh, that was not good. It was not good. Okay, let's go.
So how do you feel about, like taking out a disease in the mother's womb?
Taking out what?
A disease in a mother's womb.
Oh, so doing a surgical procedure in the embryo?
Yes.
For survival purposes?
Yes.
I have no problem with that.
Oh, okay.
That was easy enough.
Great question.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Right. Okay, we've got a couple up here and others, some in the back too.
Are there any aspects of evolutionary theory that you dovetail into your faith or harmonize within your faith?
Okay, so yes. That normally bothers Christians when they hear that. But the answer is yes. And it centers on the way you define evolution. So could you give the mic back to the gentleman for just a moment? Okay, so if you were going to define what you mean by Darwinian evolution, would you say by that change in organisms over time, or would you say common ancestry, all things came from simpler life forms? How would you define what you mean there by Darwinian evolution?
You're on the hot seat.
What's that?
I'm kidding.
Oh, okay.
Changes over time.
Okay,
not
good.
From one.
Okay, comment. So that's a fair question.
Wade, he's a lawyer. Be careful.
Okay. Okay, so if you're going to say dovetailing Darwinian ideas in the sense that everything in the living world has evolved from a single common ancestor, and that common ancestor was formed spontaneously without any kind of supernatural work, and we are eventually going to discover the interrelatedness of all living things, and every living thing is a descendant of something before it in form, then the answer is no. However, if you're going to say that the genetic makeup of living things allows them to experience, if you want to call them mutations, this is an uncomfortable topic, but if you want to call them mutations, then fine. Experience this mutation scenario where traits, for example, a mutation in a Hox gene family that would cause a slightly different structure in the animal, and that group of animals could survive, then I would say, yes, that organisms can change. That is built into the makeup of their DNA. So if that's what you mean by Darwinian evolution, then you're going to have to call me an evolutionist. So, for example, the most popular example of evolution, arguably in a textbook for evidence, is the changing beak sizes of the Galapagos finches.
books, volumes have been written about it. So if you mean by evolution that you can get oscillations in populations, that there's a new species, as it were, with a longer beak to take advantage of the available food supply, then by all means, call me an evolutionary biologist. But if you're going to extrapolate that to say that these birds become something else besides birds, now you've got a problem. How's that? Okay.
Okay, we're going to do one more.
All right.
One more. Okay.
Hi. So this is all pretty deep science. A lot of it is...
Okay, I'm sorry. It's hard to understand up here.
Okay, can you hear me better now?
Yes, slowly.
Okay. So this is pretty deep science. It's really interesting. I love how we've covered evolution, and I feel like I have a good answer now when people ask me, based on my religion, what I believe on. The other questions that always get pulled up, though, is more the miracles of the Bible, such as, you know, like we thought dinosaurs, which we've curtailed around. What is your opinion on that? When I get asked by a normal person, not a scientist, how do I relate that to the Bible? I can't relate that right now.
Okay, so the question is, so this gentleman might be a good one to talk to about dinosaur bones, but it does not do us any good as Christians, in my opinion, to ignore what science is saying. So I don't want to ignore the thinking of Darwinian writers. I don't want to ignore what they're putting in the textbooks. I don't want to ignore the fossil finds in dinosaurs. I don't want to ignore the evidence for old and or young Earth kinds of things. So you're asking me personally about how I would respond to someone about the existence of dinosaurs. Did they exist before man? Were there dinosaurs on the planet when men weren't? Okay, so this is a very hot and passionate topic among young Earth creationists, okay? And I'm sure there are some of these people in this room. See? This is what I mean. Okay. I think the evidence that dinosaurs coexisted with man is weak. So if you push me into a corner, I'm going to tell you that dinosaurs existed in Genesis 1:1 during the Reshit. During the beginning. Now, if you want some more detail on that, your pastor has some of this. I've written some of this down, and I'm perfectly willing to share it with you. But it took 2 hours at lunch to do it together. So I'm going to hide behind this. I'm sorry if I've offended someone. I don't think that dinosaurs and man lived at the same time. I know there's a fossil find in Glen Rose, Texas. I know that Ken Ham has supposedly got these massive clusters of human footprints and these fossil finds with dinosaur footprints. I know. I've seen all that. And maybe they're right. I have a hard time buying that evidence, especially in light of the dating stuff. I'm going to stop with that.
Okay, thank you. Hey, before Randy, you're coming to give us instructions. Come on, Randy, come right now. Hey, guys, can we, Dr. Warren is a very busy man. He's got a lot of stuff going on, and he gave up a big chunk of his time to be with Fellowship of the Rockies. Can we thank him for coming, please? All right.
Hey, thank you, buddy. All right, Randall, tell us what the plan is now.
All right, so you do have, you know, we're going to be around eating for a little while. I know you can't all talk to Dr. Warren during this time. I know, but good try. You can try it, though. So here's the deal, though. So we do have pizza. I'm going to pray for it in just a second. But here's the goal is if you go out these doors and walk around all the way through and come in the fireside room from the far east door, okay? So you have to go out, go all the way down the hallway through the glass doors and in. Don't come in this way to the fireside room because you're going to come in backwards. We got pizza. We got stews. His veggie tray is ready to go. And then there's some cookies and some drinks. And you can grab that and then come back in here and hang out for, you know, for as long, well, not as long as you want, but hang out in here and eat and stuff and hang out with us, spend time and visit. We'd love for you to do that. But go out and then come back in this way, okay? We do have some gluten pizza for those who want that are gluten-free, not gluten pizza. We have gluten pizza and we have gluten-free pizza as well. We have both of those. A lot more gluten than we have gluten-free, okay? But we do have some gluten-free pizza, have some veggie pizza, then we have sausage, cheese, and pepperoni pizza, okay? So those are all available. So let me pray for us, and then it'll be up to you to fight your way around, take your time. We got multiple tables. We have four lines. You have plenty. You can come through pretty quickly. So let me pray for us. God, thank you again tonight for Dr. Warren. Thank you for his time spent with us and just the amount of things that he has studied and worked on and the things you've laid on his heart, making a difference like he is in the Louisiana School District. And God, we thank you for him sharing his time with us and his knowledge with us. And he'll continue to do that. Guys, I know as we make some, he's got new relationships now. People will be visiting with him in the future as we get to share with him. Thanks for him already being invested into us and wanting to invest even more. We ask that you would bless this food to our bodies. Bless our time of fellowship, hanging out with one another and just getting to know one another. Some people don't know others in the room. Help us just to kind of find some common ground and visit with one another tonight. Thank you for Fellowship of the Rockies and for the investment made in this series as well as this weekend, God. We love you. In your name we pray. Amen.
Hey, guys, there's one last thing I forgot to mention to you. You know, a few weeks ago in church, we talked about sort of the back-to-school guide and what are our rights as American Christian believers in schools. This might be a helpful tool for you. We have copies of that available at the Welcome Center and information about how you could get the document from the Alliance Defense Fund. It's a great resource on top of this. All right, now let's eat.